All right, just a quick announcement to let you know, because of the nature of the way the weather has been over the last few weeks, I don't think we're going to have any trouble this week, but last Wednesday, I have to make a decision relatively early about class, by like 5 or 5:30, and last Wednesday at 5:30 it looked horrible, it looked god-awful. I figured, oh well, we're in for another round tonight, but by 6 o'clock it all dissipated. So I canceled, but it was too late to call and say, okay, well, we're going to have class. So just pray for me that I'll make the right call on those things, that we won't cancel when we don't need to, that we will when it's dangerous. As a second announcement, Eileen asked me to remind y'all to pray for her trip. She got off, I think, on Thursday and be gone a couple of weeks. So I don't know if I could take it. I mean, the idea of, I think there's like a 5 or 6 hour difference between just here and Paris. And the trip to Alaska, where there was a 4 hour difference, was more than enough for me. But you're going to have some jet lag and that kind of thing. So certainly pray that God blesses all that and brings her back safely so we can fellowship again. All right, well, let's make sure you're in fellowship and let's continue on here. Get before you the doctrine of Thanksgiving, but we'll finish this chapter or this verse up here first. Happiness. Yes, doctrine of happiness. So here we were into this that our citizenship, we're in a different realm. Again, we are hybrids. We are not like just unbelievers who have a single nature. We have a dual nature. That we have to seek to stay on top of to maximize our time under the spiritual nature, the new man, and then, of course, avoiding those things that ultimately would drag us down. So what Paul says next here about writing the same things has led to numerous suggestions as to what things he's referencing, since nothing in chapter 3 appears to repeat what was mentioned in chapters 1 and 2. So this has led to the suggestion, A, that Paul is referring to matters that he has previously discussed in other communications with the Philippians. However, none of those communications are extant. That's part of the problem. We don't have any other letters we could point to and say, well, Paul addressed this in this letter or this and this. But we do know, for instance, with the Corinthians, we know there's at least one missing epistle. Could be more. Could be some missing epistles here, too. We really don't know. I would expect, since it's been, 10, 11 years since the founding of that church, that there probably were some writings. But, again, not recorded for us or not saved. So it might be reasonable to conclude that Paul's close relationship with the church, coupled with their ongoing support over the years, resulted in letters that have not been preserved. And then C, others believe that the same things refers to matters Paul had communicated orally to the Philippians, which things will also have been communicated by Epaphroditus and then perhaps Timothy. Now, obviously, Timothy doesn't get there yet. In fact, there's some questions as to whether Timothy ever gets there. But Epaphroditus takes this letter. He seems to be the bearer of it. And, of course, would have given any other oral instructions. So, D, one can safely accept the third view, with the recognition that there may have also been previous letters from Paul. So, 25, in general, the same things has been interpreted in three ways by interpreters. The first is that Paul is referring to the previous command to rejoice, which will be repeated and emphasized in chapter 4. But the actual command to rejoice here in chapter 3, is really the first time he's commanded this. So he's not said this multiple times previously, that in that specific way. He's dealt with the matter of rejoicing and happiness, but no command. So again, that'll be repeated and emphasized in 4:4, rejoice again always, he says. So the second is that Paul is referring to what he is about to say regarding the Judaizers and the dangers they posed. It should be noted in verse 2, he repeats the same imperative three times. So is he to write the same things? Is he looking ahead to what he's about to write? That he has instructed them about the Judaizers previously, and there may have been communications about the Judaizers previously, and that these people are to be observed and to be avoided. So the third simply includes both the necessity of joy in the Lord and the warnings against their opponents, with the recognition that both of these matters have been addressed by Paul previously. That makes some sense. I mean, I understand that Paul would have probably addressed false teachers on more than one occasion, and that he wanted these people to be happy, and that a part of our Christian experience, a part of what helps us to live the Christian life effectively, is being happy. That happiness is a big part of this. We can focus on the pressures, the testings, the failures, our own shortcomings, the weaknesses of others, people abandoning the truth. There's all kinds of things to bring us down. But there are things in the Lord that bring us up. And this is where our happiness has to be found. So while the first view is the view of most interpreters. Now, most interpreters in verse 25 there say that this is referring to the previous command to rejoice. First, the use of the plural object, the same things, which is in the emphatic first position. When you see it in the Greek, it leads off the second, the next part of that sentence. The same things to write. And it's clearly strongly emphasizing those things. It's accusative and it's forward in the sentence. And in fact, it creates, the way Paul writes this here, creates a little a mess. No, it's not a mess, but it's odd the way he puts this. So the plural things, this which is in the emphatic first position, would not naturally be taken to refer to a singular specific command. If it's just rejoice in the Lord, if that's the thing he's talking about, that he's repeating, then why say the same things? I would more naturally expect the same thing, singular, if that's what his emphasis is. Well, Paul had only commanded the Philippians to rejoice one time to this point in the letter. Not multiple times. The only other time you can point to is Philippians 2:18. And really, that had to do with his potential martyrdom. It was a very specific matter of rejoicing. That if I am being poured out as a drink offering on the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy, and I urge you to rejoice in the same way. That's as if this happens, is kind of the idea. If this goes this way, that I'm ready, if my time is at an end, and if in some way it would benefit your Christian lives, I'm willing to die. I'm willing to be martyred for that, if it helps, and all that. So see, secondly, the use of the term asphalis. What protects or safeguards does not naturally seem to be an adjective that one would use for the value or benefit of rejoicing. Rejoicing may be a bit of a safeguard. Well, I can see in one way it is, because certainly it prevents you from the opposite, of bitching and complaining. Rejoicing is kind of the opposite of worry and complaining and that kind of thing. So I can see where you could make that argument, but that's not necessarily, I don't know that that's the term I would pick, but that doesn't mean it wasn't the one Paul picked. Well, Paul states two distinct things here about the matter of writing the same things. The first focuses on his willingness to repeat himself when he thought it necessary, while the second focuses on his pastoral concern for the Philippians. And one of the things that we've pointed out, I used to hear the constant complaint, not constant, but I hear it frequently enough, about reviewing things. That, as if these believers, some of them tend to be some arrogance in this, but as if they believed I just taught the doctrine one time and everybody oriented to it perfectly. So we never have to repeat anything if that's the case. If you get all of this perfectly one time through and we never have to cover it again, great. But is that realistic? No, it's really not. And so you have to be willing. And in fact, really, the Bible is filled with redundancy. Because we really only have two commands. Love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. And all the rest explicates those things. It explains what it means to do that. How do you go about all that? Those two commands sound simple. But what does it mean to put the Lord your God first? Well, Certainly means orienting to the royal imperatives, that you don't blow them off. You don't throw them out, the ones you don't like. These are things that you have to do. So again, he would repeat himself if he thought it necessary and cover information more than once. And because of the nature of these letters, because they're written to different churches, we get a lot of repetition. In fact, when you look at Ephesians and Colossians, they're almost identical in many ways. So it's a complete repetition. But one was sent to one church, one was sent to another, and they didn't necessarily get that repetition. We, if we do that book, I'm kind of considering not doing it now, so haven't decided yet, but I'm thinking about doing finishing Philippians, doing Philemon, and then maybe the last prison epistle I haven't touched, which would be 2 Timothy. So again, in his pastoral concern, obviously he's concerned about them. He wants them to be happy. He wants them to be safe. And he's willing to do what it does that brings about their best safety in his mind. So the adjective Paul uses, which is translated as trouble in most versions, is akneros, trouble, which is used in a couple of ways. The first describes the state of one who shrinks back from something, which denotes hesitation, reluctance, or indolence that comes from some concern or fear. People shrink back from things sometimes just because they're lazy. They don't want to do it. People shrink back from things because they're hesitant about various things. Maybe they lack confidence. Matthew 25, 24 through 26. This is in the parable of the talents, where the master goes on a lengthy trip and he gives differing amounts of wherewithal to differing slaves. One gets 5 talents, one gets 2, and one gets 1. And look, obviously the master makes this determination based on his understanding of each slave, what they needed, and what they potentially might do with it. The one in verse 20, the one who had received the 5 talents came and brought 5 more talents, saying, "Master, you entrusted 5 talents to me. See, I have gained 5 more talents." And his master said, "Well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master." And also the one who had received the 2 talents came and said, "Master, you entrusted 2 talents to me. See, I have gained 2 more." And his master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful slave." So it's clearly not about the fact that, I presume, when the master gave the second guy less talents, either he didn't need them or the master was worried about how he was going to use them, what he would do with them. Why he got less, we're not really told. Why the master does this. But the master doesn't have to answer to anybody. It's his money. He can do with it what he sees fit. Now, people call into question and task all the time, but it doesn't mean it's right. "You are faithful in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things." And here, verse 24, "And the one who had received the 1 talent came up and said, 'Master, I knew you to be a hard man.'" That's a way to impress your boss, your slave owner. "I walk up and insult him. Reaping where you did not sow, and gathering where you scattered no seed." Makes it sound like he's a criminal almost. I'm not sure what he's saying to this master, but I don't think it's very smart. "And I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent away in the ground. So here, you have what is yours." Oh boy. "And his master answered him, 'You wicked, lazy slave. If you knew that I reap where I did not sow and gathered where I scattered no seed, then you ought to have put my money in the bank.'" Any moron could have done that. Any moron could have done that, and I would have had interest on my original investment. But you didn't even bother with that. This slave is not only lazy, he has this indolence, this I don't care attitude, it seems like, that comes across in this. So therefore, take it away and give it to the one who has 10 talents. "For to everyone who has, more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But the one who does not have, even what he does have, shall be taken away. And in an application, I've never done this parable to really get into it and tear it apart and see what it's all about. But by application, the reality is when God blesses people with the truth at whatever level, and they are careless with that, they don't take care of it, they don't worry about their so great salvation, they're not, they don't care if they let things slip, that ultimately that doctrine that they have now will deteriorate and it will be gone at some point. That's part of one of the applications off of this. So the first describes the state of one who shrinks back from something. Hesitation, reluctance, or indolence. And if that's Paul's meaning here, the idea is he's not reticent or hesitating when it comes to reminding believers of important matters. See, the second deals with things that cause one to be disinclined to act. Things that are bothersome or troublesome. Which are reflected, that's what's reflected in most translation. And they translate trouble or troublesome. It is no trouble. Most of them just went with no trouble. No trouble to me and a protection to you. Most of the English translations have just used the term troublesome. Tiresome, one of them used, Young's literal. Went with tiresome. So while both concepts are appropriate to the context, Paul wisely shifts the matter of repetition being burdensome to the audience, to the matter of being burdensome to Paul himself. He doesn't say to write the same things is a burden for you. He said it's not a burden for me. Some people don't like the concept of review, but I've never been in any discipline where that wasn't a part of it. Not just church, not just the Bible. There was review in every aspect of school. I mean, whether it was history or English or mathematics or didn't matter what the discipline, science. There was review involved in it. You didn't just learn and keep learning. You had to consolidate your knowledge and relearn it sometimes even and strengthen it. So the second reason for Paul's willingness to repeat himself is seen in the benefit it provides for those in Philippi, who were the objects of his pastoral concern. The Greek adjective asphales, protective, making safe, translated safeguard, is derived from the verb sphalo, which means to fall by tripping, or to throw down even. And the alpha privative, that means there's no cause for tripping, no cause for you falling down. It negates it. So in ancient literature, the noun was used specifically of preserving or protecting one from falling down on ground that was treacherous. That's Thucydides out of the Peloponnesian War there. And the adjective was used to denote that which was steadfast, dependable, or safe. So in the New Testament, this adjective was used in two ways. The first has the sense of determining the certainty of something, ascertaining the actual facts. It's used in that way in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 21. Verse 34. But among the crowd, and this is when Paul is arrested by the mob, this is in Ephesus. Nope, take that back. This is in Jerusalem. This is when he's arrested there. But some among the crowd were shouting one thing and some another. And when he could not find out the facts because of the uproar, that's the idea of the verb or the adjective right there. He couldn't find out the facts because of the uproar. He ordered him to be brought into the barracks. And then it's used again in 22:30. But on the next day, here wishing to know for certain, that's the way it's translated there, the certainty of the facts, why he had been accused by the Jews. He released him and ordered the chief priests and all the council to assemble and brought Paul down. So 33, in this context, it has the force of providing protection or security from those who advocated a false gospel that threatened those in Philippi. However, they're only going to be protected to the event that they take this warning seriously and guard against the influences of the Judaizers. I certainly believe that in this verse, there is certainly some transition into what is coming. Because I think this is information he would have dealt with them before. This would have been something I believe Paul taught in all his churches that put them on guard against these people. He knew that out of Acts there in Acts 15 when they had the Jerusalem Council that they were not stopped there. Even though they should have been, they were not. They continued their nefarious plan to circumcise Gentiles and bring them under the Mosaic Law. Which, of course, they pointed out in the Jerusalem Council there, that never worked for Jews. And that strongly says to me, why are you so dumb to think it's going to work with Gentiles? And also, the Jews were the only ones ever placed under the Mosaic Covenant. The Gentiles weren't. Why would God wait till now if that was his plan? And the whole thing, of course, it smacks of being wrong. They're just flat wrong about this matter of putting the Gentiles under the Mosaic Law. But they're very zealous for the law. And they're very zealous for Moses. And they're zealous for the temple. And zeal without knowledge? Well, that's most people, sadly. And zeal without knowledge is a dangerous thing. And that's what he accuses them of there in Romans. I say they've got a zeal for God, but a zeal without knowledge. They don't really understand God or what he wants. But yet they're zealous for him. They're going to defend him. They're going to protect him. And they don't really have... And you see this today even with people, to some extent, these militant fundies out there marching and protesting, and they're going to change the world. And they don't understand what God's doing or what he wants even. But that doesn't slow them down. They're militants. They're going to defend God's plan whether he needs it defending or not. All right, well, the doctrine of happiness here, let's look at that. Probably a good time to review it. We could all use some, I figure. And if this one doesn't make you happy, I don't know what to tell you. We could do the doctrine of sadness. Probably won't. One vocabulary is we usually start with to explain why the concept has to be clearly taught. And this is fundamental at the vocabulary level. That if something's not taught and there's no vocabulary for it, why would you be making a doctrine about it? Not that that's stopped people. We know it hasn't. Well, the vocabulary term Escher, the first one is a masculine noun, used 44 times and found only in the plural construct form. So it's always a plural. The noun is derived from the verb Escher, which means to be straight or right, to walk in a straight path, to be successful, prosperous, or fortunate. And the noun is used as an interjection to describe the person that is to be congratulated for his spiritual prosperity and well-being. And in that regard, it can be translated as, oh, the happinesses of. Because it is a plural, although because it is a plural and it's an abstract, there are obviously various types of happiness, but sometimes a singular is maybe better there. Some suggest a translation that approaches the idea of our word bliss. The one of the most notable passages that's found in is Psalm 1, first Psalm. He talks about the spiritual prosperity and blessedness and fortunate nature of those who are favored by God. But not in terms of the fact that they're favored by God, in terms of the fact that they won't make their source the world, the cosmos. They don't look to them for answers. How blessed is the man that does not walk in the advice of the wicked? When I need advice, where am I going to go for advice? I'm going to go to a positive believer I trust. I'm not going to go to somebody out there who will maybe tell me what I want to hear. And really, ideally, when you want advice, you kind of have to go at it with the attitude of, God, I don't want somebody to just tell me what I want to hear. I need to know the truth. I need to have understanding here and be willing to hear hard things that it's not always going to also be pleasant. But the cosmos, they like to give you good advice, except their advice sucks. That's the problem with the cosmos. Their advice is very often bad. It's very often geared only to the temporal realm. It's very often geared to personal happiness, self-satisfaction, these kinds of things. And this isn't the advice believers need. So, and while it's not repeated, the idea is this blessing. The blessedness is on those who do not stand in the paths of sinners. They don't frequent those places that sinners are known to frequent. I'm sorry, but there's no ever... I cannot think of one good reason to go to a, quote, gentleman's club. or a bar anymore. I don't have any desire to go to a bar. What happens in bars, especially after 10 o'clock at night? Good stuff. No, nothing good ever happens. You never get up in the morning and see the news and say, there was a wonderful thing. People were saved at this bar overnight. Many of them have become Christians. And wonderful things are happening. And this is the kind of news you get out of a bar. No. No, no, no. Nor sit in the seat of scoffers. Those who have the time and the wherewithal and the arrogance to simply criticize. They scoff at God's plan. They don't take it seriously. And they scoff at those who do take it seriously. And these are not the people you want to associate with. And you can see also, too, this has a progression. From just listening to them, the advice, to standing with them, to sitting with them. There's a progression of deterioration here. That if the believer doesn't watch it, he will deteriorate. And he will begin to accept this stuff. So that's where the one of the most famous uses of it is. That's the very first word there. Asherah, or Asherah. That's the plural construct form. So the cognate masculine noun, Osher, one time means happiness or blessedness. It's found only in Genesis. Genesis 30. 30:13. And then Leah said, happy am I, for women will call me happy. So she named his name Asher, actually, which is a cognate off of this word for blessedness, happiness. Gil, number three here, a verb, is used 45 times. The root meaning of the verb is to circle around, from which the idea of dancing around someone in joy is derived. It is used of vigorous and enthusiastic expressions of joy or happiness. For instance, you watch a football game. If the coach is, you know, one of the more stoic types standing there on the sideline, you know, he's Bill Belichick. And his hoodie down over his head, and he's standing there. And he's very stoic, and he never really seems to respond much or get too overly emotional. And you win the Super Bowl. He may still be standing there just like this. But the players are throwing their helmets off, jumping up and down, screaming, throwing Gatorade on each other, champagne, all this stuff. Now that's the happiness we're kind of talking about. The dancing around in joy is kind of one of those. So it's used of vigorous and enthusiastic expressions. Hey, the masculine noun is spelled exactly the same. It's used 9 times, and it also means joy, rejoicing, or gladness. Gila, a feminine noun, 2 times. The noun has a similar meaning of joy or rejoicing. But it's only the 2 times it's found, it's only in the context of eschatological joy, the joy associated with the kingdom of Christ. The millennial kingdom. Isaiah 35, 2. And it kind of starts out really, the sentence begins in verse 1. The wilderness and the desert will be glad. And the Arabah, that was a very dry region down there in the southwest, will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. And it will blossom profusely and rejoice with rejoicing and shout of joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it. The majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. And then also 65:18. Again, in the millennial context. I will, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem for rejoicing, and her people for gladness. I will also rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people, and there will no longer be heard in her the voice of weeping and the sound of crying. And then you get into the millennial conditions where 100 years is going to be like your minimum. That if you die before you're 100 years old, they're going to think God wasn't blessing you. So no more 60 or 70 or whatever we have now. The one who doesn't reach the age of 100, implying that there are many who are going to reach it and move beyond it. And that's the idea because of the change in the environment. Number four here, kada, a verb three times. When it is used in the kal, it means to rejoice. When it is used in the PL stem, for instance, in Psalm 21:7, it means to make glad or cause to rejoice. Psalm 21:7 here deals with that aspect of it. For the king trusts in the Lord. And through the loving kindness of the Most High, he will not be shaken. I'm not seeing my word here, though.
Six.
Is it six? Okay. That's probably the Septuagint is seven, I'll bet. You make him most blessed forever. You make him joyful with gladness in your presence. 21:6. I got a mapping issue there I have to look at. The cognate noun here, kedwa, is used twice, once in the Aramaic and still has the sense of joy or happiness. Number five, ranan, a verb 53 times to lift up the voice to shout with joy. Sometimes the joy is expressed by a single shout, and other times it is expressed by singing. The single shout is, for instance, Leviticus 9:24. Then fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the portions of fat on the altar. And again, when you read this, you know, you really lose a lot. I mean, picture yourself standing there and then suddenly, just out of nowhere, this flame erupts. And then it just basically barbecues all this stuff. And when the people saw it, they shouted. Kind of a single group shout, it appears, and fell on their faces. There it doesn't have the idea of singing. But it can say in Job 29. The blessing of the one ready to perish came upon me. And I made the widow's heart sing for joy. There the idea they've added sing to it to express that there's more to it than just a single aspect of joy. The cognate feminine noun, ranana, is used four times and means a ringing shout or a shout of joy. Job chapter 20, same book there, verse 5. Because the triumphing of the wicked is short. That term actually there, you may not get it from there, but triumphing is the idea, the rejoicing. The exaltation of the wicked is short. Why? Because it has no real basis in reality. The wicked are not going to triumph long term. Not in God's plan. All the ungodliness and wickedness will be turned away from Jacob. And why is the joy of the godliness momentary? Well, because that's all it can be. It's temporal. And this is, again, where the joy and happiness we're talking about isn't that temporal, momentary stimulation that comes and goes. My team wins the game. Aha, I'm happy for about, 5 minutes, 10 minutes? Then you forget about it. Then you move on to the next thing. That's not Christian joy. Number six here, the verb alas, 16 times. This verb is used to describe the emotion of joy which finds expression in singing and shouting. Psalm 28:7. So there are verbal and physical expressions to this in terms of these things. The Lord is my strength and my shield. My heart trusts in Him, and I am helped. Therefore, my heart exults, and with my song I will thank Him. Alas, there has the idea, that's the song, with my song I will offer thanks, by singing is the idea. The cognitive adjective, alis, which is used seven times, means jubilant or exalted. Very, very great rejoicing. Seven, the verb sus, 27 times, means to rejoice, exult, or delight in something or someone. To take real pleasure in it is the idea, satisfaction even, Deuteronomy 28. Because obviously you're not happy about stuff that you're not satisfied with. Deuteronomy 28:63. And it will come about that as the Lord delighted over you, that's sus there, to prosper you and to multiply you, so the Lord will delight over you to make you perish and destroy you. He's going to take just as great a satisfaction in the execution of His justice as He does in the execution of His righteousness and His goodness. And you will be torn from the land which you are entering in to possess it. And, you know, you would think Israel over the years, you would think, well, in spite, they had all these warnings that these things were going to happen. And yet they've continued to ignore them. They ignored them even during the conquest generation and that, beyond all that, when they got into the period of the judges. They ignored these warnings. They still are ignoring them as a people. So A here cognates masculine noun sason, 22 times joy, rejoicing, or jubilation. Masos, a masculine noun, 17 times joy or gladness. It is often used by metonymy to represent the object which causes joy. And so it can be called the joy, which is the object that brings joy. That's what metonymy is. Psalm 48:2. Beautiful in elevation. The joy of all the earth, the whole earth, is Mount Zion in the far north, the city of the great King. So that's God's view of Jerusalem, of course. Eight here, Samak, 154 times. This verb's used a lot. Most of these, you notice, aren't used. 50 was, I think, the biggest one. Most of the rest of them are far less than that. The verb is used far more than any other to denote happiness. It denotes happiness or joy that affects the entire disposition, the type of joy that is visible on the countenance. And have you ever had, people like that, that you deal with? I'm happy. Maybe you should let your face know. Your face doesn't seem to have gotten the message that you're happy. Sameach here. Sameach is a feminine adjective, point A, a verbal adjective that means happy or filled with joy. And then Simcha. This was the name of the girl on Taxi. 94 times, joy, mirth, or happiness. It is often used of the joyful sounds that come from a feast or banquet, where one would expect people are engaging in happiness, happy behavior. They're having a good time. 1 Chronicles 12, 38 through 40. And this deals with The installation of David over Israel as king, finally accepted by all. All these being men of war who could draw up in battle formation, came to Hebron with a perfect heart. Probably perfect there has the idea of unified, complete. They were all together in their thinking to make David king over all Israel. And the rest also of Israel were of one mind to make David king. They were there with David for 3 days, eating and drinking, for their kinsmen had prepared for them. And moreover, those who were near with them, even as far as Issachar and Zebulun and Naphtali, brought food on donkeys, camels, mules, and on oxen, great quantities of flour, fig cakes, and bunches of raisins, wine, oil, oxen, and sheep. And there was joy indeed in Israel. And yes, it's a very happy time. This is an expression of the installation of David. Now the conflict is over with the house of Saul. God has died the sin unto death. Sadly, his son Jonathan died it with him because Jonathan wouldn't separate from Saul. He remained loyal to his dad, even in spite of the fact that he knew David had been selected by God to replace Saul, which is sad. And David and Jonathan got along really well. They had a great relationship. And when Jonathan died, David is devastated because he was a great friend to David. Said their love was better than the love of sex, even. So, of course, the homos want to make them queers, but that's not what it was getting at. So there, the kind of thing that would come out of a banquet or a feast, the happiness of there's peace in the nation now. One, you've got the all the enemies have been more or less subdued. Saul's now gone, and so there's peace in the kingdom, and people are happy, and one would, and this is the right thing here. Well, B, Greek vocabulary, agaliaho, 11 times means to be exceedingly happy, to be overjoyed or to exult. Agaliasis, a feminine noun, cognate, 5 times, a feeling of great happiness or joy, which is often expressed by words or movements such as smiling, jumping, or dancing. Three, euphrino, a verb, is used 14 times to cause one to be glad, to celebrate or to enjoy oneself. Luke, and this is one of the things, and of course the hardcore sort of people who want to deny everything, and I'm all for, by the way, I'm all for living a minimalist lifestyle. We don't need to. We're not here to destroy the world. We should be good stewards and not lay up treasures in the last days. We're warned about that in James 5, where the rich are chided. Come now, you rich, and howl for the miseries about to come upon you. You've picked up this last time in history to start laying up your treasure. The billions of Gates and some of these other people and Zuckerberg and Musk and all of this ain't going to amount to anything pretty soon. It's going to be worthless. They're very wealthy now, no doubt about it. But here, to enjoy oneself. And again, I believe you should live a soberly, righteously, and godly is kind of our mandate. But that doesn't rule out parties and having fun, and doesn't mean that that's to be every day all the time. But it does mean there's a place for that. As a matter of fact, while I steadfastly refuse to think that Paul was telling them, you got to throw Epaphroditus a party, and there was no indication that... But I believe they would have and probably did. And so there's a time and a place for rejoicing and getting together and being happy and all of that. And again, it's not all the time. It's not every week, even every month. Who knows? I mean, God has to provide these times. So here, Luke 15:23. This is in the context of the prodigal son who has demanded his inheritance, left his family, gone off, made an idiot out of himself, spent everything he had, and was starving in a foreign country. And decides... And he came to his senses. I love that. You can't put it any better than that in verse 17. When he had come to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, and I'm dying here from hunger? Well, this is the lot of the reversionist. Their life gets difficult and gets difficult fast and may stay difficult until God gets their attention. If they're positive under all of this, this kid appears to have been. Again, we can't know who is or who isn't. But when he comes to his senses, then he heads back to his father. And so he got up in verse 20 and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him, and ran and embraced him and kissed him, and said to him, Father, the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. And the father said to his slaves, quickly bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and come, let us eat and have a party, celebrate. This is, as he says, for this son of mine was dead. And obviously not physically dead, so you have to kind of deal with all of this. What kind of death is he talking about? And has come to life again. He was lost and has been found, and they began to celebrate. As would be appropriate in that context, under what we would call reversion recovery. Somebody comes to their senses spiritually. Hallelujah. We don't see that much. And I don't think he saw it, although, you know, one of the questions you have to ask when he said he saw him from a long way off, was the father sitting there looking every day? Did he just happen to catch sight of him on that day? Was he hoping he would return? I got to believe, as a father, yes, you hope your children will come to their senses. You hope they wake up and do the right things. Now, not to say they always will, but you hope that. So let's see, where are we here? The feminine cognate noun, euphrosune, literally good thoughts, comes from phroneo, to think well or good, well-minded, means joy, gladness, or happiness. For Cairo, a verb, 74 times, to experience happiness in conjunction with someone else. The soon prefix there, as you might know, when you see that, the soon prefix deals with accompaniment. And it has the idea of doing something with other people. To experience happiness in conjunction with someone else, to express pleasure over someone's good fortune. Luke 1:58, and this has to be in the context of... Let's see here. Zacharias and Elizabeth. And in verse 58, now this is when she finds out that she's pregnant. Mary had stayed with her. And now it's up to almost the time for her birth. Now when the time had come for Elizabeth, verse 57, to give a birth, she gave birth to a son, and her neighbors and her relatives heard that the Lord had displayed his great mercy toward her. And they were rejoicing with her. They got together with her and congratulated her and all of that. And were happy with her. So Kara, clearly one of the biggest ones in the New Testament. This family of words, obviously, is the biggest one. The experience of joy or gladness. It is used to denote the state of being joyful or happy in Matthew 25, 21. And his master said to him, here, enter into the final part of this is what we're looking for. This was that talent one. Enter into the joy of your master. So the state of being joyful, that's, joy. There's joy at your right hand and pleasures forevermore, as the psalmist says. The object that causes joy, that's in Philippians 4:1. We got that coming up here in a little bit. And in this case, he's talking to his fellow believers. My beloved brothers, you are my joy. They're the object that brings him joy. He is happy about them. Or it can be an event that calls for happiness. And that's similar, of course, Luke 2:10. That's similar to the thing there with Elizabeth. You would expect a birth would be naturally a source of happiness and rejoicing for people. It typically is. But the angel said to them, do not be afraid. This is at the announcement of Christ's birth. For behold, I bring you good news of great joy, which will be for all people. For today, and what is this great joy? There has been born for you in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord. This is the event that's going to change everything. So five here, makarizo, verb two times, to consider someone to be favored. To call or consider them fortunate, blessed, or happy. That's used in James 5:11. Talking about believers who've been run through the ringer over the course of history, whose lives we can study profitably. But he says, we count those blessed who endured, who managed to make it through. You have heard of the endurance of Job, and you have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings, that the Lord is full of compassion and mercy. And so, again, we call those people who've made it, that they are blessed. They have succeeded. The cognate adjective, makarios, is used 50 times and means to be fortunate or happy, privileged, or blessed. Seven, the Greek term autokraia is used twice and denotes the external state of having what is adequate or what is sufficient. It was also used of the state of one who supports himself without any aid from others. 2 Corinthians 9:8. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that always, having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. And there the autokraia, that you're capable of taking care of yourself, that you have sufficiency in every area in which you have a need. And then that actually beyond all that too, that you have an abundance is the idea. So internally, point eight, the term refers to the state of mind of one who is satisfied with his lot in life. It denotes one that is happy or content with his circumstances. 1 Timothy 6:6. And this isn't very many Babylonians, sadly. This does not characterize our nation. People are not happy, they're not content, they're not satisfied. They're constantly wanting more. The leech has two daughters. Give, give. And that's the American mentality, unfortunately, or what has become a lot of it. But godliness here, he says, is actually a means of great gain. Some people want to promote the godliness code because you can get rich from it. That's not us. Others can do that. We won't. But it's a great gain when accompanied by contentment. And that is that state where you have sufficient and you're satisfied. And having sufficient doesn't mean you're wealthy. Doesn't mean you have an abundance. It means you have sufficient for what you need. And again, that should be our prayer like the psalmist prayed. Don't give me too little, lest I steal and profane your name. And don't give me too much, lest I forget you. People have a tendency to forget about God during prosperity. Now, when it comes time for trouble and turmoil and all that, and you're facing death, they're on God all the time. They're ready to call on God right then. They may ignore him the rest of the time, but bring them up to a deadly or a dangerous situation, and they're screaming bloody murder for God. Not that it's going to make any difference, but the fact is, people are not content in this country. We have to fight all this because we're surrounded by it. All of us have had believers. We know believers who have been our friends who are just nothing more than monetary reversionists. All they're about is the money and the details and the things of life and filling up their houses with junk. I'm not going to live that way. I don't think it's wise. I don't think it's healthy. I think there's some mental problems there, not just spiritual problems, that you want to live that way, almost bordering on hoarding. Don't want to be a hoarder. There's no that. How is that content? That shows a complete lack of contentment, in fact. All right, well, we're going to stop there. We got at least the vocabulary done. We'll be ready to continue here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that this information would be sanctified to our souls and our future growth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.